So, Boker Tov to everybody. Please take a seat. There are a few seats left. Welcome to there's a series of shirim, as we just heard, in honor of Yom Yerushalayim, Be'ezrat Hashem, unbelievably exciting, the 50th anniversary of the taking of Yerushalayim back into Jewish hands. There'll be many different kinds of subjects, all linked and themed with Yerushalayim, leading up to the climax, please God, in a couple of weeks of the big celebrations. There are a number of them, including the OU, who are having a major celebration here in Yerushalayim. So if you're interested in that, please ask for details, and they'll be able to do that, and I should be there myself, and hopefully many other people too. We are going to mark Yom Yerushalayim, please God, this week and next week, by giving a two-part shiur on a fascinating topic, which is controversial, contemporary, halachic, hashkafic, political, although I'm not getting into politics, but it's hard to avoid on this particular topic, which is the issue of going on to Har HaBayit. This will be a shiur in two parts, part one this week, part two next week. There will be no shiur on Yom Yerushalayim itself, because the whole area will be obviously excited and dedicated to a lot of people coming here. And then the week after is Shavuot, so obviously there'll be no shiur on Shavuot. But this week and next week we're going to go forward with this great topic. Today I'd like to introduce the topic and start talking about some of the topography to get a feel for it. This was brought home to me a number of years ago when I was walking into the Kotel. And the same happened to me this year. And I was lining up from the Shar HaShabbat to get to the regular entrance to the Kotel. And I looked up at the big wooden ramp, and you all know what I'm talking about, which is the entrance to the Mughrabi gate. That is the only entrance that non-Muslims are able to use to get into the Temple Mount. And I saw, to my great surprise, many years ago now, many, many people dressed in Yom Tov clothes with tzitzis and hats, and this year I saw strimals and bekishes, all waiting to go onto Temple Mount. And I thought, this is very strange. Like, since when is anyone going onto Temple Mount? This is a movement which is growing, but obviously in the religious Zionist world, although we'll see next week there's a lot of opposition to it in all different worlds, but increasingly in the Haredi world as well, where there are more and more people going onto Har HaBayit, people who come from America, people who live in Eretz Israel, and therefore we need to really address the pros and the cons, the ups and the downs, and see how this works. I'll give you full disclosure at the beginning, a bit like the Tcheles. I've never been on Har HaBayit, okay? Neither has my family, to the best of my knowledge, although my son-in-law is quite an avid Har HaBayit man, and I've had some interesting discussions with him about that, but we'll see the issues as to who doesn't, and why. I've listed five issues at the top, which are things I'd like to talk about this week and next week. First of all, this week we need to talk about the temple, where it stood, how it was orientated, and try and work out where it is. Where are the places on Har HaBayit which create the problems? That's number one. The issue of Tumah and Tahara, which comes up, we'll see a little bit this week and more next week. Then we need to look at Mor HaMikdash, people who go up there. What can they do? What can't they do? What are the limits and halachas of being on top of Har HaBayit? We need to look at some of the hashkafic issues, which next week we'll pick up. Why should we be on Har HaBayit? What is the overriding meta-halachic framework for going up there? Or why should we not dafka be on Har HaBayit? And then we need to talk a little bit about politics. Obviously, you can't avoid it, but that's not in any way going to be the main theme. So let's get into the maps. This week there's a lot of maps on the sheet, because you need visual aids in order to understand what's going on. So let's start with a map on page one. You can see here a topographical map of the Temple Mount. You see in black, in the more bold black, the current walls of the Old City, which of course are recent. Those are the Ottoman walls dating from the 16th century. The dotted line, which you can see on that map, is the original line of the original Old City, which was in the time of the first and second Beit HaMikdash. That was much more the line of the city, which is slightly to the south, meaning what is currently the Christian quarter and the Muslim quarter was not really in the Old City then, but what is currently the Armenian quarter and the Jewish quarter and outside the walls on Har Tion, on Mount Zion, that was all part of the Old City. And of course, Ir David, which was rediscovered about 100 years ago, and I hope you've all been down there. There are basically two or three hills. There are three hills we need to think about. There's Har Zion, which of course Mount Zion, where the Diaspora Museum is, and a number of different churches on the top there, as you see as you go from Mamilla up. Then there's on the other side Har Zeitim. Everybody knows, I hope, where Har Zeitim is, where the big cemetery is there. And then in the middle, like we talked about last week, like the head between the shoulders, is Har Hamoria, is the Temple Mount itself. And that is, according to everybody, where the temple was built. But even before then, that is the place midrashically where Adam HaRishon was created, before he was placed into Gan Eden, whatever that midrash means. We're not necessarily taking it in a literal way, but we have to understand it not for now. The site of the Korbanot of Adam, Cain, Noach, the place where Yitzchak and Rivka davened for their children, the site of Yaakov's dream. These are all midrashim and important ones. But even in the Sukkim, we can locate this place very, very clearly. Go to page 2, and let's look at the first source on page 2. The first time in Tanakh that Har HaMoria is mentioned is as Akedat Yitzchak. Number 1. Vayomer, God said to Avram, Kach, na, et bincha, et yichidcha, asher ahavta, et Yitzchak. Take your son Yitzchak, the lech lecha. This, of course, is the second lech lecha. Avram has two lech lechas. The first one, he has to leave home, from Haran, from Ur Kasim, and this one he has to go to Akedat Yitzchak. Take Yitzchak el Eretz HaMoria, to the land of Moria, which may come, Rav Yol Ben Nun told me, once it comes from the Emorim, the people who live there, okay? V'ha'alehu sham le'olah, bring him up as an offering, al echad ha'orim asher omer alecha, on one of the mountains. So there is a mountain in Eretz HaMoria, which is the place, says the Sukkim, of the Akedah. We'll join this all together a little bit later. Fast forward around 800 years, and you end up with David HaMelech. The context here is as follows. There is a plague in Yerushalayim. People are dying on a regular basis, and David HaMelech doesn't know what to do. And look at that, let's pick it up in number 2. Umalach Hashem Amar El Gad Leimor said to the following, Leimor Le David, to say to David, David has to go and build a mizbeach in the land, on the grounds of Arnon Hayivusi. Now, if you remember from the Tanakh, from Sefer Yoshua and Shoftim and Shmuel Aleph, the land of the Yivusim was not conquered by Yeshua and the Shoftim. It remained in the hands of the Canaanite, Yivusi, Hittite kings. The Yad David b'dvar Gad, so David of course follows God, his Navi, and he goes up, Asher diber b'shem Hashem. The Yashav Arnan, v'yera et malach, Arnan was sitting there, and he saw malach, v'arba v'navi mo, he was sitting there with his four sons. Mitchadim, v'arnan dashchitim, and he was threshing the wheat. V'yavad David al Arnan, v'yabet Arnan, v'yarva et David, he saw David, the king of the Jews, coming. V'yaitim in a goran, v'yishachu le David. He bows down, of course, the king of the Jews is coming to see him, something's going on. Vayomer David el Arnan, Tna li makom hagorel. I want to buy this place where you have your threshing floor. Ve'ed nabo mizbeach l'Hashem, I've been told I need to build a mizbeach. Be'ketzef mali tenehu li, I will pay good money for this. Ve'teyatza magifami al ha'am, and we will stop the plague. This is how I've been told to stop the plague. I will buy your threshing floor. Vayomer Arnan le'Arnan says David, Kach lecha, v'yad Adoni ha'melech, atol be'inav. Chas v'sholem, I'm going to take money from Melech Yisrael. Take it, have it, it's my honor. Take it for yourself. Re'ei netati ha'bakar la'alot, I'm going to throw in the cows, you can have the cows as well. V'amor egin le'itim, and you can do a wood, v'achitim, le'mincha, you can have the wheat, you can make an offering, it's a whole package deal. I'm going to give you a good deal, David. You can have the whole thing. Vayomer HaMelech David la'Arnan, and David HaMelech replies, Lo, ki kanoi ki nebekesef malei. I'm not going to take it from you as a gift. I'm going to buy it from you, bekesef malei. Ki lo esa asher lecha la'Hashem v'ha'alot o la'chinam. I can't just take a free gift and bring up a man. What is this a replay of? Abraham with Maratha Machpelah. Clearly this is a, where have we seen this before with Avraham Avinu? Clearly you know that the psukim are telling us to be tuned in to something is about to happen here on the same level, of the same nature as Avraham Avinu making his first acquisition in Eretz Yisrael, which for us is a cosmic moment when Avraham Avinu connects with that land in Maratha Machpelah, that is the first time that he gets an achuzah, an actual ownership of the land of Israel, and that's a moment of incredible intimacy. That's why, by the way, we connect that at a wedding. When a chosan and kala stand under the chuppah and he gives her a ring and he says, Hari Abba Kodeshetli, the halachic mechanics of how that chuppah works is exactly the same and learnt in Gemara Kiddushin from the halachic mechanics of how Avraham Avinu buys the land of Maratha Machpelah. Obviously under the chuppah, no, she's not buying him and he's not buying her, but what they're doing is they're making this chibur, this connection, chibur is of course from Hebron as well, they're making this connection, which is this intimacy, this beginning of a fantastic new relationship. And that's one of the reasons, I think, why there's all sorts of midrashim that Avraham Avinu sent the opening to Gan Eden in Hebron. You heard this idea that he found there, there's all this whole idea of Gan Eden, which we also bring up at the Chuppah, but Gan Eden Mikedem, it's a Gan Eden moment. It's a Hebron moment, and here we're built up to see this is going to be one of those moments. Vayitin David la'anam, but my comment is in bold, shikleis zahav mishkal 600 shekels. Vayivin sham David mizbech Hashem, he builds the mizbech, vayal olot u'shlamim, he brings the korbanot, vayikra'el Hashem, he cries out to Hashem, vayanehu ba'esh, and he is answered with fire, min ha'shamayim, which reminds us again of the inauguration of the Mishkan, al mizbech ha'olah, down onto the altar, vayomeh Hashem le'malach, vayashev chabo al nedana, and the sword which was hanging over Yerushalayim, this plague which was threatening them, was, as it were, withdrawn. David saw he'd been answered. In this special place, and he made a mizbech there. Mishkan Hashem asher asa Moshe, and the original Mishkan which Moshe had made in the Midbar. Umizbech olah ba'et ahi b'bama b'Gibon. At that time, the Mishkan was still in Gibon up in the north of Jerusalem. David lelechel lefanav lidrosh elokim. David couldn't go there at that time. Because there had been this whole thing with the plague. For Yom David, and finally David said, "Zehu Beit Hashem Halukim." This place that I just bought, that I just built, this mizbeach is going to be the house of God. Zeh mizbeach l'olah l'Yisrael. This now is going to be the place for all of the sacrifices of the Jewish people for all time. Now, of course, as you know, he himself did not build that house, but his son did, and this is where it all connects together in number 3. Vayachal Shlomo livnot et Beit Hashem. Shlomo eventually began to build the Mikdash b'Yerushalayim, b'Har HaMoriah. And it was built on Har HaMoriah, asher nireh David avihu, where God had appeared to David, his father, asher hechin b'makom David b'gor Arnon Yebusi. In that place, in that threshing floor of this Jebusite king, Arnon Yebusi, there it all comes together. This is Har HaMoriah, says the Psukim. This is the Mokam HaMikdash. This is where the Akedah happened. This is where David HaMelech bought this land for good money and made it the place that would be forever the center of Jewish worship. And from that moment, halakhically, the Jewish people are no longer allowed to have any other Mikdash or in any other place. Yerushalayim is the place and nowhere else. Chazal, of course, picked up on this idea that David HaMelech paid money and insisted on paying money, just like in Hebron. And there is one other place which was bought, clearly in the Psukim, for money, which was Yosef's tomb. And Chazal, with, I think, absolute knowing irony, said in number 4, in this famous source from Bereishis Rabbah, V'yikin et chelkat asari asher natar shama holo, b'mei ksita. This was Shechem, where Yaakov bought this plot in Shechem. Amar Rav Yudin Bar Simon, this is one of 3 places where the non-Jewish world could never accuse the Jewish people, Loma, and say to them, Gezulim hein biyadchem, you are settlers, this is not your place. 3 places they could never say, Chazal have the chutzpah to say that. The Eluhein, and these are they, Maratha Machpelah, Ubeit HaMikdash, Ukfurot HaShal Yosef. And when Chazal are writing this 2,000 years ago, just 2 weeks ago, in UNESCO and in the United Nations, Dafka Maratha Machpelah and Dafka Har Habayah, I'm sure they never read this midrash, but Dafka, those 2 places are the places where they said these are the places the Jews have no history, no basis. Chazal knew this. When Chazal say they could never have the chutzpah, they know that they for sure have the chutzpah.
They did.
For sure. and he goes through the psukim, Beis HaMikdash Gavid paid, and Marmat Matzela Avon paid, and Kever Yosef Yaakov paid. And therefore, we know these places. These are places which are, and when I said these are cosmic moments, these really are. These are the places that give Donald Trump a headache when he goes to bed at night. I suppose in North Korea as well, but that's not in the Midrash. But for sure, you know, things change, but some things never change. So this is the Mokam HaMikdash. This is the place where undisputably we had our Beit HaMikdash. And I want to go through a little bit of a historical context just to bring you from the Beit HaMikdash up to the current day. And I put that at the bottom of page 2. So there was a Beit HaMikdash, a first Beit HaMikdash, and it was destroyed by the Babylonians, you know that, and the Jewish people were sent to exile. They came back and it was rebuilt the second time, and it was destroyed again by the Romans. This we know. 70 CE was destroyed by the Romans. But what happened after that? So first of all, there is evidence, and we had a whole shiur on this last year before Pesach, that even though the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed by the Romans in 70 CE, there is quite a lot of evidence that the Jews continued to bring korbanot in the ruins of the Beit HaMikdash. Because you don't need a building to build to bring the korbanot. And that we looked at a little bit last week, and we looked at it in more detail when we talked about can you bring korban Pesach today. We had a shiur on that about a year and a half ago. So there is evidence that that was done. But after the Bar Kokhba revolt, that was all ended. Hadrian clamped down on the Jewish people in around the year 135. He plowed the whole thing over. He put a pagan temple on the top of Temple Mount, and he renamed Jerusalem Aelia Capitolina. Aelia was one of his names. And the Temple Mount from that point was off limits for Jews. Jews were not allowed there. One day a year, Tisha B'Av, they were allowed to mourn for the Mikdash. The rest of the time they were expelled from Yerushalayim, and they lived mostly in the north, in the Galil, etc. Even the Talmud Yerushalmi, so-called, which was written around this period, was not written in Yerushalayim. It's called Talmud Yerushalmi as a kavod for Yerushalayim. It was written in the north because the Jews were banned from Yerushalayim. The Romans themselves, of course, became Christian, the Council of Nicaea in 325. Constantine built churches. His mother also came, built many churches. And there are churches, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre there, which has its background from this period. And Temple Mount was abandoned. If you remember, there is a map, a mosaic map, which there's a copy of in the Cardo. It's called the Madaba map. And it's a copy of a mosaic that was found in a church in Jordan some years ago. And this is a Byzantine map of Yerushalayim, showing the Cardo, which is very clearly there, and the little mini Cardo, which is by the back of the Western Wall Plaza where the Davidson Center is. All of the roads are there on that map, what we call now Shah Shem, the Damascus Gate. You see it very clearly there on the map. One thing is not there. Temple Mount. It is absent. It is invisible. Because as far as the Byzantines were concerned, Temple Mount was now an icon. It was a symbol of God's rejection of the Jews. It was in ruins. It was out there. Of course, they didn't use it for pagan worship. Of course, the Christians were not interested in pagan worship. They left it as a sign that Loyalenu God had abandoned the Jewish people, and that's why it was never built up. There were many people who came after that. There's a famous account from someone called the Bordeaux Pilgrim in the 4th century who came and he talks about Temple Mount. He came from France. There was a brief moment where the Romans went back to being pagan. There's an emperor called Julian the Apostate, they called him, because from a Christian perspective he was, and he gave the Jews permission to rebuild Har HaBayit and to rebuild the temple in the 4th century, but it never got off the ground. They started, and he was soon killed, and it was all left in ruins. There was an earthquake in Yerushalayim, and again, there were times when people were called to build temple, tried, failed. Eventually, the Arabs invaded. In 638, the Arabs invaded Yerushalayim, and they looked at the ruins of Temple Mount, and they said, this is not acceptable. We also consider this place to be holy. Why do the Arabs consider it to be holy? First of all, it was already holy, and they piggyback off the Jewish holy places, just like the Avot, etc., etc. But also, they said that Muhammad, on his last journey, goes up and up from there, from the special rock where they say that he flew up to Shamayim. He went to the very edge, to the Katseh, from the same word as Muktzeh, to the Katseh, and the edge of the Arab kingdom, and from there he went to heaven. Of course, the word Katseh was turned into Al-Aqsa, and Al-Aqsa, from the word Katseh, with the edge there, they built a mosque there, and they built a dome to commemorate that. The Dome of the Rock was built in the 6th 80s, 690s. It is not a mosque. Strictly speaking, it is above this special rock. More about the rock in a minute. And that, it's basically remained in Muslim hands after that. There are accounts of the Jews going up there. We'll see those much more next week. But eventually the Jerusalem was invaded by the Crusaders, and the Dome of the Rock became a church. The Templum Domini, remember the Knights Templar? All those Dan Brown books, etc., that you've probably read. Some of you, yes, some of you know. The Knights Templar were up there. There is an account, which we'll see in the source next week, of the Rambam visiting what was almost certainly the Temple Mount and davening in the Temple Mount. We'll see how that works. But eventually the Jerusalem was recaptured by the Muslims, and the Mamluks took over. Once the Mamluks took over in the 1250s, they basically closed the whole place down. They said, Muslims only, no Jews, no Christians, nobody else is allowed, and that's basically how it stayed for around 600 years. Now, in 1517, the Ottomans invaded. This was seen as being a very potentially messianic moment, because the Ottomans were much more laid back than the Mamluks in many ways in their attitudes to the Jews, and this coincided also with the expulsion from Spain, 1492. There was a Jewish yeshuv set up in Sfat. Remember all the shuls in Sfat, the Bey Rav, Rabbi Yaakov Bey Rav, and the Bet Yosef, etc. And the Ottomans took over, and this gave the Jews great hope. Eventually, in the middle of the 1800s, there was, I'm not getting into a whole history lesson, but the Crimean War was a very important turning point. Turkey, the Ottomans at that time, needed the British. They needed help against the Russians. And therefore they opened up a lot of things that were up until that time closed. For example, in the 1860s, they gave permission to non-Muslims to buy land and own land in Yerushalayim and in Eretz Israel. The Christians, of course, came, built many of the churches that are now in the Christian quarter on Mount Zion. They were all built in this period. The German colony was built up then, because that's when the German Protestant Christians came, because they were allowed. But for us, of course, this was critical, because this was the beginning of the new Yeshua, where Rothschild was able to come in, buy up land, Zichron Yaakov, Pesach Tikva, etc., etc. Prince Edward, the Prince of Wales, who later became Edward VII, was one of the first non-Muslims to go up onto Har HaBayit. He came on a tourist trip, and they allowed him, because of course the Ottomans were trying to be extra friendly, and they allowed the Prince of Wales up there, and of course this was the time of when Charles Warren came and started making his maps, etc., and doing his archaeological investigations. Eventually, to cut a long story short, 1917, exactly 400 years after the Ottoman invasion, the British General Allenby invaded from the south, Battle of Gaza, etc., came up to Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim was not fought over. There were trenches where we used to live in Haranof, down in the forest. There are Turkish trenches, Ottoman trenches, ready to repel the British. In the end, it didn't happen that way. I'm not getting into how Yerushalayim was captured by the British. It's a fascinating story, a very funny story as well. But the British took it. General Allenby came. They called Allenby Al-Nabi. Al-Nabi, the prophet, because everybody thought this was going to be the beginning of something big. The Jews were excited. The Muslims were excited. Everybody was excited because, of course, the British had promised everything to everyone. Everyone was going to get a country. The Hashemites are going to get a country. The Jews are going to get a country. Everyone, King Fahd, everyone's going to get a country if they help them beat the Germans and the Ottomans. Of course, when they won the war, they had to work out who's going to get all these countries. And that's why we are in the situation we're in today, to some degree. And of course, even now, today, there is a whole campaign going on in the British Parliament to try and force the British government to apologise for the Balfour Declaration. At the moment in England, in the United Kingdom, there is a Conservative government who have told people there is no way in the world that we're apologising for the Balfour Declaration. But there is an election on June the 6th, and we'll see what happens after that. I doubt that there'll be a different government in place after that, but if there's a Labour government, then you might just get the apology that they were looking for. But that's another story. I promise you no politics, certainly not English politics. 1948, the Jordanians invaded, and of course they took Temple Mount. During the British Mandate, there were Jews that were allowed onto Temple Mount. And we'll talk about that next week. We'll talk about Rav Kook's reaction, we'll see his posters, etc., and people, what people said at the time. But the Jordanians captured in 1948. They promised, of course, that Jews would have access to holy places, but that was nonsense. They had no access to anything. If you were American and you could get through Jordan on an American passport, there was a potential way to get into Jordanian areas, but basically no Jews allowed. In 1967, the Israeli army conquered Har HaBayit, And since then, we have held Har HaBayit in Israeli sovereignty. Of course, the Waqf have day-to-day control over the site, and that is the difficult, uncomfortable relationship which pertains to this day. And we will talk next week about what people can do, what people can't do up there, and how that balance is kept. So that's the basic history. I'm sure you knew that, but it's good to go over it. Go over to page 3. You need to look at these diagrams and remember them, because we'll be talking about them today and next week. This is basically what the Beit HaMikdash looked like in the time of Herod. It's slightly incorrect because it was square. It wasn't meant to be rectangular. But this is basically how it is. West is on the top. Today's Kotel is up where it says in writing, Har HaBayit Tafkuf Al Tafkuf Amma, just above there. There's a little black line with white writing in it. That is basically where today's Kotel is, the southern wall, that corner, the Davidson Center, etc. Basically, the temple was a large open area, Temple Mount, in which there were a number of courtyards. And you can see towards the left of that diagram, there's the Ezrat Nashim, which was a square courtyard enclosed by a wall, the Ezrat Kohanim, the Ezrat Yisrael, rather, the Ezrat Kohanim, and then this sort of upside-down T-shaped building, which is the building of the Mikdash itself, the Ulam, which is the big wide hall, into the Heichal, and then into the Kodesh Kedoshim, which was right at the back. Now, in the Second Temple times, there was no Aron HaKodesh. So what was in the Kodesh Kedoshim? A rock called the Eben HaShtiyah, the foundation stone. Does that rock still exist today? Well, there is a big rock up there. Just turn for a second to the very last page, to page 10. We'll flip back to the rest soon. On the bottom right-hand side, you can see a nice picture of the rock, which is in there. Now, that is the rock that the Muslims built the Dome of the Rock over, which they say was the place from which Muhammad goes up to Shemayim. But is that the rock of the Eben HaShtiyah? Yes or no? And we'll see, it is not at all clear. It is not at all clear. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But there is a rock in there, and you can go online, see many pictures of that. Even the Jews who go on to Temple Mount, they for sure do not go into that area. We'll talk about that in a minute. But there's no shortage of pictures of it available. So we'll talk about that rock a little bit more soon. Go now back to page 4. Let's look at some sources and see what you could and couldn't do in this area. In the Midbar, there were 3 camps. The Jewish people had an overall camp called the Machane Yisrael. Inside that, there was a camp called the Machane Leviyah, where the Levim were allowed. And in the middle was something called the Machane Shekhinah, the camp of the Shekhinah, where the Mishkan building was located. What could and couldn't be done in these 3 areas? So look in source number 5. There's a pasuk at the beginning of Parshas Nasal there that says the following. Tzav el et b'nei Yisrael, command b'nei Yisrael, v'yishalchu min ha-machane, they have to send out from the Machane 3 groups of people, called Tzarua, anyone who has Tzara'at, V'chol Zav, anyone who is a Zav, we will define that more next week, but along with a Zav goes a Zav, a Zava, a Nida, a Yoledet, we will define all these terms, but not this week, next week. V'chol Tamei Lenefesh, anyone who has been in contact with a dead body, they also have to be taken out of the Machane. Rashi explains which people from which part. Look at Rashi, please, on the first line, number 5. It says Rashi. Shalosh machanot hayu sham b'shat chaniyatam. When they were camped, there were 3 machanot, like I just described. Toch hakilayim, the innermost curtains, hi machane shechina, that is the machane shechina. Then chaniyat halevi'im saviv, then the levi'im around that. U'misham v'atzof machane adigalim, and from there to the end of the Jewish camp with all the different tribes, v'chol arba ruchot, in all 4 directions, hi machane Yisrael. Just like I described to you, shechina, Leviyah, Yisrael. Now, Rashi explains from Chazal. Hatzarua nishtalach chutz l'kulam. Someone with Tzara'at had to leave the whole thing. They had to be outside the Anani HaKavod, outside the entire camp. So that's them. They're out of all 3. Hazav, which we'll see again is a Zav, a Zav, a Nida, Yoled, etc. Mutar b'machane Yisrael. They are allowed in the Machane Yisrael. U'mushulach mina shtayim. But they're just excluded from the inner 2. From the Shechina and the Leviyah. They're allowed in the outside one, but the inner 2 they're excluded. The Tamil and Nafesh, which is the lowest level, Af B'Shel Leviyah, they're allowed even in the Machane Leviah. The Ein Mishulach El Mishal Shechina. They are only excluded from the innermost camp. So again, just to reiterate, someone with Saras is out of all three. Someone who is a Zav is out of the inner two, but can be in the outside one. And someone who is a Tamei Meis is basically excluded from all of them. Or rather, he's excluded from the inner one. He's excluded from the inner one, but is allowed in the outer two. Excuse me. Now, how does that work in Yerushalayim? How does that work in Yerushalayim? So the Tosefta in Kalim translates what they had in the Midbar into what we had in Yerushalayim. Kashem, number six. Kashem shehayu b'midbar shalosh machanot. Just like we had in the Midbar three machanot. Machane Shechina, Machane Leviyah, u'machane Yisrael. Kach hayu b'Yerushalayim. They had the same setup in Yerushalayim. This is how we have to envisage this today, because we are now in Yerushalayim, although as we said last week, we're not in the original Yerushalayim, and we're not in the Kadosh bit of Yerushalayim, but once you end up in that area around Har Tzion, the Kedush of Yerushalayim remains. So how did it work? Mi petach Yerushalayim ad petach har habayit machane Yisrael. So from the walls of the city of Yerushalayim to Har Habayit, that was called Machane Yisrael. Now, who was excluded from Machane Yisrael? Tzarat. Someone with Tzarat. So if you were living in the times of the Mikdash in Yerushalayim and a person had Tzarat, so they had to be outside the city walls. They could live in, you know, Harnof or something like that. They could live in the forest, they could live somewhere else, but they can't live inside Yerushalayim. Okay? So that's Tzarat. Goes on the Tosefta. Mipetach har habayit. The Ad Shar Nikanor, from the entrance to the Har Habayit, up until the entrance to Shar Nikanor. Shar Nikanor is the entrance to the Ezrat Yisrael, in from the Ezrat Nashim. Machane Leviyah. Oh, so that is the Machane Leviyah. So we see now that Har Habayit has the status of the Machane Leviyah, which is, who's not allowed there? Well, someone with Saraf is not allowed there, like anywhere in Yerushalayim, but also Zav, Zava, Nida Yoledet, not allowed on Har Habayit. They are allowed in Yerushalayim, but not on Har Habayit. And finally, Mishar Nikanov Lifnim, from Shar Nikanov Lifnim, Machane Shechina. So from there, okay, even a Tamei Meis is not allowed, or a Zav, or etc., etc. But a Tamei Meis is allowed on Har Habayit. A Tamei Meis is allowed on Har Habayit, because a Tamei Meis was allowed in the Machane Leviyah, and that is the equivalent of Har Habayit. So for our purposes, discussing Temple Mount, who is not allowed to go onto Temple Mount? Well, someone with Saras, definitely. And somebody who is a Zav, a Zava, a Nida, or a Yoled. But someone who is Tamei Meis is allowed on Temple Mount. They're just not allowed in the middle bit, which was the actual temple precinct itself. So in theory... We'll see. Allowed if they prepare, but we'll see. So in theory, if someone today is a Tamei Meis, which we all are, you're allowed on Temple Mount. As long as you don't go into the areas which were the inner sanctum, the area from the Shar Nikanor and inward. But if you're only walking around Temple Mount, as long as you're not a Zav, a Zava, a Nida, or a Yoledet, in theory you're allowed on that. Saras is not a problem for us, because nobody has Saras anymore. Why not is a different shear? Not for now. It's not obvious why we don't have Saras today, but we don't. So that's where the Mishnah in Kalim in number 7 picks this up. So we looked a little bit at this last week. I put numbers in black, they were not in the original Mishnah, but the Mishnah gives 11 different levels of Kedusha. Chutz La'aretz is the lowest level of Kedusha. Then Eretz Yisrael is up from that. And then walled cities is up from that. And then Yerushalayim is even up from that. And then next up is Har Habayit. Look, pick it up on the third line where there's a little number 4 towards the end of the line. Says the Mishnah, Har Habayit mukudash mimenu. Har Habayit is on a higher level of Kedusha than Yerushalayim. Why? She'ein zavim v'zavot v'nidot v'yoladot nichnasim l'sham. If you're Zav, Zav, and Nidhi, you're not allowed into Har Habayit. You are allowed in Yerushalayim, but not Har Habayit. And then he goes up, Hacheil mikudash mimenu, that's the fence going into the courtyard area. That's a level higher. She'ein ovdi kachavim. If you're an Ovid Kachavim, if you're not Jewish, you're not allowed there. There was a sign, by the way, a sign that they discovered from the original Mikdash, from the Second Temple, written in Greek, of course, because if it's for non-Jews, you've got to write in the language there and they can read, which says that non-Jews are kindly requested not to proceed beyond this point, or at least he would have said that if it was in England. In Israel, he probably said something more kind of, you know, straight. Okay? So non-Jews are not allowed beyond there. V'tamei meit, they are not allowed nichnasim l'sham. And then it goes a stage further, number six. Ezrat nashim mekudesh mimenu she'ein tibut shavul yom nichnas l'sham. V'ein chavim alev ha-chatat, but you're not chatat, meaning it's not the most serious. And then seven, eventually, Ezrat Yisrael mekudesh mimenu she'ein mechusa kiporim nichnas l'sham. V'chayavim aleha chatat. Now that we're going to have to get to right now. Because there is an area in the middle, which is this area that a tamei meit and nobody is allowed into if they're tamei of any kind, and there comes a point when if you cross a certain line, you will indeed be chayav. Chayav what? So chatat was the korban that a person brought if they went there by accident. They were tamei and they strayed in. But what if a person did that on purpose? Chayav karet. And that's why we have to look now at number 8, because we know that a person who goes into certain areas is chayav karet. Number 8, shloshim v'shesh kritot b'torah. Says the Mishnah, there are 36 types of Chiyuv Karet. Not that many, there are many, many thousands of mitzvot, only 36 are Chiyuv Karet. Most of them are forbidden marriages of different kinds, but then as you know, there's, you know, Shabbos, breaking Shabbos in public on purpose is one, and eating chametz on Pesach is one. There are ones that are familiar. Another one of them is Haba leMikdash Tameh. If you come in a Mikdash Tameh. So, many people say, you will have heard, or if you go onto Har HaBayis, Tamei, you're chayav karet. So that's not true. You've just established that's not true. Because the chayav karet only begins if you go in the middle. The question is, of course, where is the middle? We'll get to that in a minute. Yes?
Every Rosh Chodesh, Rabbi of Richmond, makes up a group on Harabai.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. Next week, we'll talk about exactly how they do that. He's not alone. There are many people. If you're interested in a fun video, you can look at Rav Moshe Tendler. Rav Moshe Tendler goes on to Har HaBayis at every opportunity, and they took a little video of him a few years ago on Har HaBayis. Just Google it back home, Rav Moshe Tendler on Har HaBayis, and you'll see his trip. Right. Many people go to Har HaBayis. We're just establishing how they do it and what they do. We'll see next week. So fine. The Rambam passing is number 9. Ezrat Yisrael mekudeshet me'ezrat nashim. The Ezrat Yisrael is more holy even the Ezrat nashim. She'ein mechusa kipurim nichnas l'sham. I'm not getting into what that is exactly. But tamei she'nichnas l'sham chayav karet. And if you go into there, you are chayav karet. So even the people who go into Har HaBayis, they don't go everywhere on Har HaBayis. There's a maslul, there's a route, and they do not go in the middle. And we'll see why that is as well, and where the middle is. However, the Rambam says number 10, tamei meit. If you're tamei meit, afilu hameit atzmo, even a dead body itself, you can even take a dead body onto Har HaBayis. I'm not recommending it, but that's possible. Okay, mutar likanes to Har HaBayis. You're allowed to even take a corpse onto Har HaBayis. Shneema v'yikach Moshe et atzmo yosef. Moshe had the atzmo yosef with him. Where did Moshe live? Which machane? Machane Leviyah. Where's the machane Leviyah in modern Yerushalayim Har HaBayis? Moshe lived there with the Atmot Yosef nearby, Imo, the Machane Leviyah. And therefore, says the Rambam, it's absolutely permitted, in theory, as long as you permit, prepare yourself, to go onto Har HaBayis, even Tamei Met, as long as you're not a Zav, a Zava, a Nida, and a Yoledet. Now, next week, let me give you a little bit of a preview. We're going to have to work out, how do we know if you're one of these people? Well, Sarah, as we already said, Baruch Hashem, nobody's worried about. A Yoledet is a woman who had a baby in the last 7 or 14 days. If you don't know whether you're one of those people, that's another problem which we need to sort out. But most people are pretty clear whether they've had a baby in the last couple of weeks. And Nida is also pretty clear. People know when yes, when no. Zav and Zava is a bit more complicated. We have to work that out. Can you get, can you become Tahor from being Nida, Zav, Zava, Yoledet? Yes, you can. There is a system. Meaning Tamei Meit, we're all Tamei Meit. There's nothing to do about it because you need a Para Aduma. And without a Para Aduma, you're really, you know, you don't have any way of becoming Tahor. But Zav, Zava, Nida, Yoledet, you need a Mikvah. And Mikvah we do have, but the question is what kind of Mikvah? We'll talk about that next week. Because you can't just pop along to your local men's Mikvah if you want to go to Har HaBayis. That doesn't necessarily work for reasons that will be evident to you next week. Let's now, for the rest of the Shir, try and work out where everything is. Where was the temple? Page 5. So we know the size of Temple Mount. We've already said Har HaBayis was like this Machane Leviyah. Number 11, Har HaBayis, says the Mishnah, lots of different Mishnayot today. Har HaBayis haya chamesh meot amma, al chamesh meot amma. 500 ammas square. Well, we don't know exactly how big an amma is. An amma in theory is from the tip of this finger here, which is called the amma, to the elbow. But just like the expression in English, a foot, is not dependent on the size of your feet. So an amma is probably not dependent on the size of your arm either. There's a standardized measure, and therefore there's a debate as to exactly how big an amma is. But one way or the other, it gives us an area of approximately 90,000 square meters. Okay? Between 48 and 90,000 square meters, depending on how big you measure your amma. Your chazanish, sheer amma, your smaller sheer amma, whatever it is. So Har HaBayit, we know, was that size. But Temple Mount, and now from now on I will be very specific, when I say Har HaBayit, I mean Halachic Har HaBayit. When I say Temple Mount, I mean the place that we have today. Temple Mount is much, much bigger than this. Temple Mount is not a square 500 by 500 amas. It's actually a trapezoid with uneven sides, which is more like 150,000 square meters. Now, the maximum Har HaBayit can really be is around 90,000 square meters. So we know for a fact that there are large parts of Temple Mount which were not Har HaBayit. How did that happen? And the answer is very clear. It's the first thing they tell you when you go on the Western Wall Tunnel Tour, that there used to be a little hill called Har HaBayit, on which was a small temple, first temple, second temple. Along came King Herod and decided this little temple is not good enough for him. He needs to build a mega temple. The problem, of course, is if you have a hill like this and you put a temple like that, it's not going to work. You need to build a hill. How do you build a hill? Very simple. You create a large retaining wall. You build archway structures, one on top of the other, extremely strong. You fill it in and you build a platform on top. And lo and behold, you have the Temple Mount. Now, that is much bigger than the original hill. That is how Har HaBayit expanded to be the size of Temple Mount. Is that holy or is that not? Well, we saw last week, and we'll see next week, King Herod did not have the things that you need in order to create Kedusha. Remember what we said you need? A king. Well, that's a Jewish king, not King Herod. It's a proper king. You need Urim and Tumim. We didn't have that. You need a Sanhedrin, and you need a Navi. Well, he didn't have a Navi either. All he had was a Sanhedrin. It doesn't work. Maybe, says Rav Kook, it works on some kind of rabbinic level, but it doesn't create the Kedusha on a Torah level, for sure not. So we know that there are parts of Temple Mount which have the Kedusha of Yerushalayim, but not the Kedusha of Har HaBayit. And in theory, even if you were a Zava, a Nida, or Yoledet, if you went there, that wouldn't, strictly speaking, be wrong. The question is, where are those places? So let's have a look now at Temple Mount. I'm going to give you a couple of pictures. Look at bottom of page 5. This is a picture of Temple Mount with north at the top. Somewhere in that trapezoid shape is Har HaBayit, a square which is Har HaBayit. Now there is a suggestion in the dotted line, maybe that's where the square is. Lots of people have investigated this, archaeologists, others, academics, to suggest where that might be, and there are maybe even indications on the hill itself, on the mountain, of where things began and where things ended. Almost certainly Al-Aqsa, the mosque itself on the south side of the wall, probably did not fall within the original Har HaBayit. That is, according to most people, the add-on bit from King Herod. But with that in mind, look for a second at page 6. This is Har HaBayit as it, Temple Mount, I should say, as it looks today. There's the Dome of the Rock in the middle, but there are many other domes. There's the Dome of the Chain, there's the Dome of the Spirit, the Dome of the Ascension, there's of course the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the south side, which has its big dome, and there are many, 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 many gates. The only gate that non-Muslims are allowed to use is the Moor's Gate, okay, the Mughrabi Gate, which is Mughrabi is from the word Marav, okay, Marav, the Western Gate. But if you walk through the Muslim Quarter, which I'm sure many of you do or have, you will see many, many other entrances onto Har HaBayit, which Muslims are allowed to use, but non-Muslims, Jews or Christians, are not allowed to use. You can walk around up Rachof Hagai, up there to the Via Dolorosa, then cut up right up the Via Dolorosa, and you'll see that skirts the northern side of Temple Mount. So that's what it looks like today. How are we going to work out where the temple used to be? Now let's come back to the rock. What is that rock? The rock that I showed you a picture of. So Rav Goren. Rav Goren was one of the, of course, most famous people to go up onto Har HaBayit, together with Moshe Gur and the paratroopers in 1967, the iconic pictures of him blowing the shofar, making the bracha, etc., there on Har HaBayit. Rav Goren held very clearly, and he's written extensively on this, that that rock is not the rock under Holy of Holies, under the Kodesh Kodashim. It is not the Evan Ashtiyah. It is the rock under the Mizbeach. So says Rav Goren, that rock is where the Mizbeach was. So according to him, and I brought you a picture A, which is people call the central system, that rock, meaning the dome of the rock, is right smack bang on top of the Mizbeach. That puts the Kodesh Kodashim very close to the Western Wall. Okay? Right up. And of course, people have done the Western Wall tunnels. There's a little area where people daven, say Tehillim, etc., which is the closest point to the Kodesh Kodashim. For Rav Goren, that's close indeed, because his temple, if you like, layout, was very to the west. So he says that that is where the rock was. That's called the central system, which would put Har HaBayit approximately on the map that I've given you on the top right. However, the most popular, the most well thought up system, is called the middle system, which is, the Radbaz and others, is that the rock is actually indeed, yes, the Evan Ashtiyah, which is, in fact, put that rock right under the Kodesh Kodashim. According to that, in B, that would put the temple a little bit further to the east, but still around that middle area. So we so far have two views. The Rav Goren, who says that the rock is the rock of the Mizbeach, and the Radbaz and many others who say that the rock is the rock of the Evan HaShtiyah, which is the Shatiyah, which is the Kodesh Kodashim. However, it's not so simple, because if you go over to page 8, you'll see that there is another more northerly system which understands that actually the temple may have lain slightly to the north of that, and there is a southern system that many of the archaeologists hold is correct, which is to the south of that, and therefore even though the middle theory is the most popular, which is the one people normally assume to be correct, if you put all of this together, you end up that Har HaBayit could be pretty much anywhere on Temple Mount. And therefore, people who go up onto Temple Mount today assume that to be the case. They assume we don't really know which bits of Temple Mount are actually not even Temple Mount, that they're not even Har HaBayit, that they're really just Yerushalayim. And they assume that anywhere they go, once they walk through that gate, anywhere they walk on that Maslul, pretty much could be Har HaBayit with its full Kedusha. Which, as we said, means for a Tami Mase, no problem, but for a Zav, a Zava, a Nida, a Yoledet, yes, a problem, and therefore they prepare on that basis. So now you basically understand a little bit how people connect Temple Mount with what was Har HaBayit. Look for a second on page 9, there's two more pages of pictures to go. Page 9, it's not such clear print, but this gives you a much better picture of when people go onto Temple Mount, where do they go? So there is a Maslul, there is a route called the Maslul HaRadvaz, which is the most common route used by people on Temple Mount, which goes as follows. If you look carefully at this picture on page 9, you'll see, you can clearly see in the middle the Dome of the Rock, and you can see that little Aleph. You see that little Aleph in the middle of the Dome of the Rock? Which is Kodesh Kodashim. So that Aleph is assuming that the rock was in fact the Kodesh Kodashim. But if you look just underneath that Aleph, you'll see a little Gimel. You see a little Gimel? That's Rav Goren's, remember Gimel for Goren, that's Rav Goren's assumption of where the Kodesh Kodashim was. It's slightly faint, you'll see just under where it says Kodesh Kodashim. And then if you look a little to the left, you'll see a bet in a dotted line. That is where the northern system people think the Kodesh Kodashim may have been. And then if you look, this is the faintest of all. On the other side, a little dallard in a dotted line, that is where the southern system people think the Kodesh Kodashim was. So basically, when people go up onto Har HaBayit, they say, we just have to avoid all of those. So this dotted line, this more darker dotted arrow, I should say, you see the dotted arrows? They go, follow them at the bottom. You see where it says HaKotel? So they go up through there, they walk to the right, and then turn left, up through the southern area near Al-Aqsa, meaning they don't go into Al-Aqsa. Non-Jews are not allowed, non-Muslims, are not allowed into Al-Aqsa. Al-Aqsa is on the far right of that picture. You can just see the dome there on the, with the courtyards down the far right of the picture. So they walk up to the left of Al-Aqsa to where that sort of woody area is, a little bit more green, and then they turn left, walk over the other side, and then turn left again, and then walk down and then make that circuitous route. That is a route which basically avoids, according to every Shita, the middle. Because that's what we're trying to avoid. The middle is the area that you can't go if you're Tamei Meis. And given that we're all Tamei Meis, the middle is the place that everybody wants to avoid, and therefore that's what they do. Finally, if you look on page 10, you'll see a couple of slightly better maps. Page 10 is another version of the route, the Maslul. Very similar, but it goes nearer to the eastern wall, which people use when they walk around. And also, there are other routes as well. I brought one on the bottom right, bottom left, excuse me, which is quite faint. But it's basically that's the key. So let's just summarize and then give a preview of what we're going to do next week. What have we discovered so far? We've discovered that Har Habayit, Har HaMoriah, is so connected in so many ways from the Akedah, from David HaMelech, from Shlomo HaMelech, first base of Mikdash, second base of Mikdash, etc. There is no doubt that that's where it was. And by the way, all of the Islamic sources up until the modern political times accept clearly that this was the Temple of Solomon. The modern political view that the Jews have no connection with Temple Mount goes against all Islamic literature up until the modern day conflict, the Arab-Israeli conflict. So it's clearly nonsense, and everyone who is Islamic will tell you it's nonsense if you ask them. What else have we learned? We've learned that someone who is a Tamei Meis may indeed go on to Har Habayit, as long as they don't go in the middle, and we've talked about where the middle is. Someone who is a Zav, and Nidah Yoledet, may not. And there is a way of dealing with Zav, and Nidah Yoledet, we'll talk about next week. And therefore we just have to work out what we should do with all this information. Meaning, do we go there? What is the purpose? What is the benefit of going there? What do we get out of it? Do we show that this is a Jewish place? There's maybe a mitzvah of Kibush Haaretz. Maybe it's a mitzvah d'oraita to go to places where dafka, the enemies of the Jewish people, say you don't have a connection with, to say that we do have a connection with. Or maybe there is a danger. There's a halachic danger. Maybe someone will be chayv kores by mistake. They would go on the middle bit, although we'll see next week. There may be opinions that wherever you go on Har Habayit, there's no chayv kores anymore. And do we follow that opinion? Do we feel that it's a political nightmare? Do we feel it's a disaster waiting to happen? Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, who is one of the leaders of the Gush and Datilumi, communities in Eretz Israel, very famous, he gets people upset sometimes when he says and repeats again and again. There is no mitzvah d'oraita to go on to Har Habayit, he says, but there is a mitzvah d'oraita not to set alight the tinderbox of Middle Eastern politics by starting a major conflict just because you want to go on to Har Habayit. On the other hand, if we never did anything because we were scared that people are going to start another this or another that, then we'd all run away and live in Los Angeles, and we wouldn't be here at all. So this is a very delicate balance. And again, I'm not interested in dealing with the politics. I can tell you what other people say about it. But next week, what we'll look at is as follows. We will look at how we deal with Zav and Nidah Yoledet in practical terms, and who goes on to Har Habayit. We will look at the different psachim of the different communities, Haredi community, the religious Zionist community, different communities in Israel and abroad. And finally, we look at, if you do go on to Har Habayit, how does one behave? What is one meant to do? What can one do? What is one allowed to do by the WAC, by the Israeli police, and by the halakha? Lots more to talk about. Please tune in next week, and we'll do part two. Yes, Ricky? Okay. Okay, there's a special lecture here on Sunday, 12:15, Tzipporah Pilz, who lives across from Har Habayit, telling us about the whole issue, her experience living there. So hopefully we'll see you next week. Please God, have a great week.